I emphasize the plight of the poor, but I recognize, of course, that there are substantial middle classes even in the underdeveloped world. For these people, basic survival may not be an issue, but still, they endure hardships that make everyday life a strain. One problem is that the basic infrastructure of the Third World is abysmal. The roads are not properly paved, the water is not safe to drink, pollution in the cities has reached hazardous levels, public transportation is overcrowded and unreliable, and there is a 2-year waiting period to get a telephone. Government officials who are very poorly paid are inevitably corrupt, which means that you must pay bribes on a regular basis to get things done. Most important, there are limited prospects for the children's future. In America, the immigrant immediately recognizes things are different. The newcomer who sees America for the first time typically experiences emotions that alternate between wonder and delight. Here is a country where everything works. The roads are clean and paper smooth, the highway signs are clear and accurate, the public toilets function properly, when you pick up the telephone you get a dial tone, you can even buy things from the store and then take them back. For the Third World visitor, the American supermarket is a thing to behold. Endless aisles of every imaginable product, 50 different types of cereal, multiple flavors of ice cream. The place is full of countless unappreciated inventions, quilted toilet paper, fabric softener, cordless telephones, disposable diapers, roll-on luggage, deodorant. Most countries even today do not have these benefits. Deodorant, for example, is unavailable in much of the Third World and unused in much of Europe. What the immigrant cannot help noticing is that America is a country where the poor live comparatively well. This fact was dramatized in the 1980s when CBS television broadcast an anti-Reagan documentary, People Like Us, which was intended to show the miseries of the poor during an American recession. The Soviet Union also broadcast a documentary with a view to embarrassing the Reagan administration. But by the testimony of former Soviet leaders, it had the opposite effect. Ordinary people across the Soviet Union saw that the poorest Americans have television sets and microwave ovens and cars. They arrived at the same perception of America that I witnessed in a friend of mine from Bombay who has been unsuccessfully trying to move to the United States for nearly a decade. Finally, I asked him, "Why are you so eager to come to America?" He replied, "Because I really want to live in a country where the poor people are fat." The point is that the United States is a country where the ordinary guy has a good life. This is what distinguishes America from so many other countries. Everywhere in the world, the rich person lives well. Indeed, a good case can be made that if you are rich, you live better in countries other than America. The reason is that you enjoy the pleasures of aristocracy. This is the pleasure of being treated as a superior person. Its gratification derives from subservience. In India, for example, the wealthy enjoy the satisfaction of seeing innumerable servants and toadies grovel before them and attend to their every need. In the United States, the social ethic is egalitarian, and this is unaffected by the inequalities of wealth in the country. Tocqueville noticed this egalitarianism a century and a half ago, but it is, if anything, more prevalent today. For all his riches, Bill Gates could not approach a homeless person and say, "Here's a $100 bill. I'll give it to you if you kiss both my feet." Most likely, the homeless guy would tell Gates to go to hell. The American view is that the rich guy may have more money, but he isn't in any fundamental sense better than you are. The American janitor or waiter sees himself as performing a service, but he doesn't see himself as inferior to those he serves. And neither do the customers see him that way. They are generally happy to show him respect and appreciation on a plane of equality. America is the only country in the world where we call the waiter sir, as if he were a knight. The moral triumph of America is that it has extended the benefits of comfort and affluence traditionally enjoyed by very few to a large segment of society. Very few people in America have to wonder where their next meal is coming from. Even sick people who don't have proper insurance receive medical care at hospital emergency rooms. The poorest American girls are not humiliated by having to wear torn clothes. Every child is given an education, and most have the chance to go on to college. The common man can expect to live long enough and have free time to play with his grandchildren. Ordinary Americans enjoy not only security and dignity, but also comforts that other societies reserve for the elite. We now live in a country where construction workers regularly pay $4 for a non-fat latte, where maids drive very nice cars, where plumbers take their families on vacation to Europe. As Irving Kristol once observed, there is virtually no restaurant in America to which a CEO can go to lunch with the absolute assurance that he will not find his secretary also dining there. Given the standard of living of the ordinary American, it is no wonder that socialist or revolutionary schemes have never found a wide constituency in the United States. As sociologist Werner Sombart observed, all socialist utopias in America have come to grief on roast beef and apple pie. Thus, it is entirely understandable that people would associate the idea of America with a better life. For them, money is not an end in itself. Money is the means to a longer, healthier, and fuller life. Money allows them to purchase a level of security, dignity, and comfort that they could not have hoped to enjoy in their native countries. Money also frees up time for family life, community involvement, and spiritual pursuits. Thus, it produces not just material, but also moral gains. All of this is true, and yet, in my view, it offers an incomplete picture of why America is so appealing to so many. Let me illustrate with the example of my own life. Not long ago, I asked myself, what would my life have been like if I had never come to the United States, if I had stayed in India? Materially, my life has improved, but not in a fundamental sense. I grew up in a middle-class family in Bombay. My father was a chemical engineer, my mother an office secretary. I was raised without great luxury, but neither did I lack for anything. My standard of living in America is higher, but it is not a radical difference. My life has changed far more dramatically in other ways. If I had remained in India, I would probably have lived my entire existence within a 1 mile radius of where I was born. I would undoubtedly have married a woman of my identical religious, socio-economic, and cultural background. I would almost certainly have become a medical doctor, an engineer, or a software programmer. I would have socialized within my ethnic community and had cordial relations, but few friends, outside that group. I would have a whole set of opinions that could be predicted in advance. Indeed, they would not be very different from what my father believed or his father before him. In sum, my destiny would to a large degree have been given to me. This is not to say that I would have no choice. I would have choice, but within narrowly confined parameters. Let me illustrate with the example of my sister, who got married several years ago. My parents began the process by conducting a comprehensive survey of all the eligible families in our neighborhood. First, they examined primary criteria, such as religion, socioeconomic position, and educational background. Then my parents investigated subtler issues, the social reputation of the family, reports of a lunatic uncle, the character of the son, and so on. Finally, my parents were down to a dozen or so eligible families, and they were invited to our house for dinner with suspicious regularity. My sister was, in the words of Milton Friedman, free to choose. My sister knew about and accepted the arrangement. She is now happily married with two children. I am not quarreling with the outcome, but clearly my sister's destiny was, to a considerable degree, choreographed by my parents. By coming to America, I have seen my life break free of these traditional confines. I came to Arizona as an exchange student, but a year later I was enrolled at Dartmouth College. There I fell in with a group of students who were actively involved in politics. Soon I had switched my major from economics to English literature. My reading included books like Plutarch's Moralia, Hamilton, Madison, and Jay's Federalist Papers, and Evelyn Waugh's Brideshead Revisited. They transported me to places a long way from home and implanted in my mind ideas that I had never previously considered. By the time I graduated, I decided that I should become a writer, which is something you can do in this country. America permits many strange careers. This is a place where you can become, say, a comedian. I would not like to go to my father and tell him I was thinking of becoming a comedian. I do not think he would have found it funny.